He read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. He outsourced his life to India. He lived for 1 year according to all the moral codes expressed in the Bible. This hour, author A.J. Jacobs. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, my conversation with author A.J. Jacobs about his two latest lifestyle experiments, his year of living biblically, and his most recent exploration of different ways to reach peak health. That's captured in his latest book, Drop Dead Healthy. A.J. Jacobs was a guest this week at Iowa Wesleyan College. A.J. Jacobs, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is author A.J. Jacobs. Jacobs was a guest this week at Iowa Wesleyan College. Jacobs says he sees his life as a series of experiments. He immerses himself in a project or a lifestyle, for better or worse, and then he writes about what he's learned. In one of these experiments, several years ago, Jacobs read all 32 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. He wrote about that in his humorous book from 2004 titled The Know-It-All. In 2005, Jacobs outsourced his life to India. The idea behind that was that personal assistants would do everything for him, answering his emails, reading his children goodnight stories, even arguing with his wife. He wrote about that for Esquire. In 2007, Jacobs came out with a book, The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. It chronicled his experiment to live for 1 year according to all the moral codes expressed in the Bible. His most recent book, from 2012, is titled Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. And in that one, he explores different ways humans can bring their bodies to peak health. A.J. Jacobs, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about your most recent book, if we could, and then your Year of Living Biblically. Your most recent book is titled Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. And in this one, this most recent one, you explore different ways humans can bring their bodies to peak health. And you know, AJ, this is a perfect discussion for us. I don't know if you know this, but we here in Iowa have a healthy state initiative. Several communities in Iowa are adopting so-called blue zone practices. I don't know if you know of those. Dan Buettner.
Sure. I'm a fan and a friend of Dan Buettner.
Okay. Start off by telling us what condition you were in when you started this endeavor.
Well, I was not in blue zone condition. I was I never went to the gym. I ate whatever I wanted. I wasn't traditionally fat, but I was what they call skinny fat. So my body looked like a snake that had swallowed a goat. I was not in good shape.
And that's been most of your life?
Yes, I kind of ignored my body for about 40 years. And then I got sick. I was in the hospital with pneumonia. And my wife said to me, I don't want to be a widow in my 40s. You've got to get in shape. And that was sort of the impetus for this book. If I'm going to get in shape, I'm going to go all in like I do my other projects. And I thought I would test out every bit of medical advice I could find and see what worked and see what didn't and try to revamp everything. So from my exercise routine to my diet, sleep schedule, sex life, posture, you name it.
Mm. So in preparation, you went sort of pulled together a team of expert medical advisors. Is that right?
Right. So I had doctors, nutritionists, trainers, geneticists, anyone I could find who had some respectable letters after their name.
You came up with a 53-page list of things to do to improve your health. The Blue Zones have 9, by the way. They're called the Power 9. But you have a 53-page list. Tell us some of the things that you put on that list.
Well, it was a challenge because if you really follow all the medical advice, that's a full-time job. You've got to quit your day job because you've got to exercise and meditate. Meditating is very good for you. If you follow the dermatologist's recommendations, you've got to put on sunscreen, a shot glass full of sunscreen every 2 to 4 hours. So that's like half an hour of your day.
Even if you're living in Manhattan? No.
Even in Manhattan and even in the winter. This is what the dermatologists say. They're a little overzealous, I think. You've got to pet dogs. There's lots of studies on how healthy that is. It lowers blood pressure, hypertension. So I didn't have a dog, so I would go to the dog park and pet other people's dogs, which was met with a mixed reaction, but I was on a mission. You have to make your own food because, as you know, processed foods are terrible for you. You've got to eat your own food, and this is actually kind of time-consuming if you're doing this properly because we are a nation of under-chewers. We need to start masticating more. I ran across this movement on the internet called Chewdeism, and they believe that we should be chewing 100 times per mouthful, which is kind of insane. I do not recommend that. But I think we should chew more.
Chewdeism, did you try that out, actually? Do it for longer than a day?
I did try it for about a week, and it's very difficult. I mean, you can't really have a conversation, so I'm not orthodox Chewdeism, but I do believe that chewing, you get more nutrition, and more important, it slows down your eating. Anytime you can slow down your eating is good because then you will eat less, and portion control is half the battle.
You had on this 53-page list of things to do to improve your health, also traditional things like eating leafy green vegetables, lifting weights, but you also had one that stuck out, win an Academy Award?
Yes, there are studies that show that people who win Academy Awards live, I believe it's 3 years longer. I have it in the book. But so I figured that would be a nice way to boost my lifespan. Unfortunately, I did not achieve that one. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to become a woman from Okinawa because they have the longest lifespan. But again,
that was unachievable.
That I did not check off my list.
In this book, you explore different ways of bringing humans to peak health, and you broke down this quest into sort of body parts or systems. So we talked a little bit about the chewing, the digestive system, but let's go through some of these systems. Let's start with the heart. You have something in this book called the caveman workout. Describe what that was about.
This is a workout that some people do here in New York where you basically go to the park, you take off your clothes, and you work out like cavemen. So you climb trees and you throw boulders. And, it was a lot of fun. It's not something I do regularly. To me, the important thing is to find a way to exercise that you enjoy because otherwise you're never going to do it. So, yeah, if you enjoy throwing boulders and pretending to be a caveman, go for it. But it could be anything. It could be gardening. It could be bicycling. Doesn't matter as long as you're moving.
In Manhattan, were there people actually regularly doing this caveman workout in Central Park?
Yeah, there were. And part of it is sprinting because you have to run and pretend there's a saber-toothed tiger behind you. And a pack of like 12 grown men sprinting is very alarming in New York City. So we got a lot of looks and people running away from us.
Loincloth as well?
I went with the shorts,
okay.
Bike shorts, which was, I figure, a modern-day loincloth.
Also on your list for heart-healthy things to do was pole dancing. You tried that out.
I did. That's the most popular class at my gym, so I figured I would try it. It was a vigorous workout. I gained a new level of respect for strippers, although there was no stripping involved in this class. And, again, it's all about moving, so it doesn't matter. You know, that one I won't do again. I was the only man among 50 women. I am married, so it didn't do me any good. But if there are single men out there, this might be a way to meet some members of the opposite gender.
So what makes pole dancing deceivingly difficult?
Well, you have to hold on and support your entire weight, so it's a huge upper body workout.
Mm-hmm. Also, you ended up for your heart healthy exercises creating some kind of style of fitness called gorilla exercise. What was that?
Well, this is because here in America, we tend to compartmentalize our exercise. So if we're dutiful, we go to the gym for an hour a day. But the rest of the time, we're sitting on our butts. And this is almost, the research says this is almost as bad as not going to the gym at all, which is very unfortunate. So any way you can work movement into your day is great. So I talk about gorilla exercise. So just taking the stairs instead of the elevator is an obvious one. When I talk to my young kids, I squat down so that I'm at their face level. So I'm always doing squats throughout the day. I started to run errands because that's what they call it, running errands. So I would run to the drugstore, buy a toothpaste, run back. My biggest change was that I put my computer on top of my treadmill and I started doing a treadmill desk. So I wrote the book while walking. So It took me about 1,200 miles.
We've heard about these treadmill desks. We've talked about it in the office here at Iowa Public Radio. It must be difficult to get used to. Is there some trick to it, or do you give yourself a week or two to get to adapt?
Well, you know, I am not a coordinated person, trust me, but I'm able to do it. So I think it's actually not that bad. It's like, you know, walking and chewing gum. Most people can do it. You just walk and type at the same time. And it's actually, instead of being distracting, I find it helps my focus because there are studies that say when you're walking, it raises your serotonin level, which is really important for attention. So I find myself even more productive when I'm walking. And now if I sit down and try to work, I fall asleep.
So this, unlike the caveman workout or pole dancing, this is something you've held on to even after this experiment?
Yes, this is something that has changed my life. And I wear a pedometer because there's lots of research that says that if you keep track of how much you walk or keep track of any part of your health, then you're going to act in a healthier way. So I have a little pedometer and I try to get to 10,000 steps a day. And I'm actually online and have little competitions with my friends about who can take more steps. I also found a great website called earnedit.com where you can convert your steps into points. And if you get enough points, you can donate something to charity. So I donate clean water to Haiti. And that is serious motivation because if I'm sitting down, I feel like I'm depriving people in Haiti of clean water. And I feel like a terrible person. So I got to get up and do it.
If you just joined us, my guest this hour is A.J. Jacobs, an editor at Esquire magazine, author of several books, Know It All, the New York Times bestseller, also the Year of Living Biblically, and his latest book we're talking about now, Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection. Now, in this mission, this quest for bodily perfection, A.J., you found out how sex figures into the goal of fitness, and what did you discover there?
Well, sex is generally healthy. You know, there are exceptions, but consensual sex is definitely something you want to try to do. And I learned, I tried all these aphrodisiacs because there's all this research on what helps and what doesn't. Turns out, scientifically, none of the aphrodisiacs really work. And I learned from a scientist, a great scientist named Helen Fisher, who talks a lot about the brain and love and sex. The aphrodisiac, the only one that really works, is to do something new and exciting with your partner. That could be, you know, going to a new restaurant in a different neighborhood. It could be taking a vacation, just doing something novel, because that raises the dopamine and testosterone level in your brain, and those are the only real aphrodisiacs.
You did try some bizarre aphrodisiacs?
Well, I did try. There is research that in an actual peer-reviewed study that says that the odor that women find most arousing is a combination of cucumber and Good and Plenty candy. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So I sort of mashed up my Good and Plenty candy and put it in some cucumber juice and sprayed it around the room to try to get my wife in the mood. Not a success. Not, I don't recommend that. I don't, maybe it works on other women. It was not something my wife was keen on.
I like the try a new restaurant idea much better myself.
It's a little easier, too.
You explored the little known health hazards of noise pollution. I think, AJ, everyone knows someone who has hearing damage due to noise or loud music. What did you find out?
Well, we live in the loudest society ever, so I think it really is interesting to see the health problems that are coming up. And as you mentioned, hearing loss is the obvious one, and I think that it's just going to get worse. But it also – noise affects your cardiovascular system because when there's a loud noise, evolutionarily, we are trained to go into fight or flight mode. So we are so it raises our stress level. And there are real studies that show that if you work in a noisy environment, it can raise your risk of heart disease by 2 or 3 times. So I do think it's important to try to live a quieter life. So I'm a big fan of earplugs and noise-canceling headphones, although I seem to keep losing my noise-canceling headphones, which is very stressful because they're expensive. So I don't know. That might be balancing out.
Right. It's probably very difficult to get escape noise, some sort of noise pollution as you live in Manhattan.
It's true, but it's not just an urban problem. You know, there's leaf blowers and agriculture is very noisy. So I think it's a nationwide problem.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any research that people, say, living in Manhattan or other places get used to noise if they grow up with it and just block it out? No?
No, you do not get used to it. I mean, your mind might get used to it, but your cardiovascular system does not. Interestingly, though, I did feel a little better because New York has, you know, we have terrible air, which is probably decreasing my lifespan. But we also walk a lot, and that counterbalances the pollution. So actually, people in New York have a slightly higher lifespan than the average American.
Hmm. Back to things to do with your stomach, we talked about Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also something there called a paleo diet that you tried out. What's that?
Well, this is the theory, and it's very trendy right now, that we should only be eating foods that our Paleolithic ancestors ate because our bodies are designed by evolution to eat that, and that includes meat and vegetables, but no grains. It's a carb-free diet. It's very similar to the Atkins diet. So I tried that, and you know, it was interesting. It does help you lose weight if you're off carbs altogether. So there is evidence that if you want to lose weight, then lowering the carbs might be helpful. But in terms of long-term on how it affects your heart, I think the jury is still out. And the bulk of the evidence still is with a vegetable, plant-heavy diet with meat on the sort of as a side dish. Mm-hmm. So that's in the end what I've settled on, sort of the Mediterranean diet, which has been getting a lot of press lately.
Mm-hmm. And you figured out a way, or you tried to eliminate sugar, what, completely from your meals still?
I did, which is really hard. I mean, Americans eat 5 times the amount of sugar that is recommended by the Heart Association. We are addicted to this stuff. So any way you can cut it out is good. Eating fruit instead of dried fruit, for instance, or juice, that is helpful. So stick with the way it came out of the ground. And all of those artificial sweeteners and they are not – the research is still out, but it doesn't seem that, for instance, agave nectar is really any better for you than sugar.
Oh, sugar shoot. Sugar. I just changed from honey in my tea to agave. So that's
– I'm sorry to break it to you.
Oh.
You know, there is a little bit of evidence that stevia is better than your average sugar. So
stevia, where does that come from? I don't even know that one.
It's a leaf, a stevia leaf, but they grind it up. I mean, if you're really hardcore, you do the leaf and put the leaf in your tea. Mm. But they also sell it in powder form.
Mm-hmm. For this experiment to become healthy, drop dead healthy, you wore a pedestrian helmet around Manhattan for a week. Why would you do that?
Well, that one was more of an experiment. I didn't expect it to make me all that much healthier. But safety is such a does not get a lot of play. You know, when you open Men's Health or Women's Health, you don't see a lot of articles on safety. You see a lot of articles on abs. But safety really has a huge effect on our health. I mean, much larger than many other things. So trying to be the safest person in the world was part of my experiment. So that meant, you know, installing bars in the bathroom so you don't slip, because so many deaths occur from bathroom falls. And there's research that walking, you get pedestrian accidents. There are more pedestrian accidents than bike accidents. So in a sense, it's not illogical to wear a pedestrian helmet.
So pedestrians walking around and perhaps not maybe listening to their iPod or something and not just being tuned into what's happening around them?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. There is that YouTube video of someone walking into a manhole.
I think. I haven't seen that.
In China.
But yeah, well,
in China,
texting.
People just in their own world, right?
Right. Texting and walking. It was Denmark actually had a public service program to encourage pedestrians to wear helmets. They had little signs saying a walking helmet is a good helmet. So I thought I'd take their advice and see what happened. And I think you do get enough strange looks that I don't recommend the walking helmet. But it was just to prove that there are dangers that we underestimate, and one of them is walking. So, yeah, stop texting and walking.
One of the areas you explored was, in this era of hand sanitizers on everyone's desk, you looked at how to protect yourself against germs. What surprising findings did you have there?
Well, my wife and I are split on this, because I'm a bit of a germaphobe, and I'm scared of all surfaces, whereas she thinks that we've become a too hyper-vigilant society and it's actually bad for you. And there are a lot of doctors who agree with her. They call it the hygiene hypothesis, that we wash our hands so much that we've lost the ability to fight off germs, to build a resistance. Now, there is, I think, more there's not a huge amount of evidence that the hygiene hypothesis is right. Again, the jury's still out. It's a hugely complicated issue. But during my year, I met with a germ specialist who basically enabled all my fears and listed all of the horrible germs lying on everything from your cell phone, which is, you know, dirtier than your toilet seat, to your kitchen counter, to your sponge. That is a hot zone. So I still am a big fan of hand washing, and not just putting them under, dipping them for a second, but doing the whole happy birthday song.
A.J. Jacobs is my guest this hour, an editor at Esquire magazine, the author of several books based on experiments in lifestyle, you could say, the author of the New York Times bestseller Know It All, a book for which he read all 32 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. We're just talking about Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection, his latest from 2012. If you could stay with us, A.J. Jacobs, after the break, I'd like to talk with you about your 2007 book, The Year of Living Biblically. One Man's
Sure, we'd
Humble
love it.
Okay, let's do that. One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. We'll talk about A.J.'s quest when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is A.J. Jacobs, editor with Esquire magazine, author of the New York Times bestseller, Know It All, also Drop Dead Healthy, his latest book from 2012. And A.J., I wanted to talk with you this half hour about your 2007 book, titled The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. And this is a book in which your experiment is to live for 1 year according to all the moral codes expressed in the Bible. And you start out the book by describing that while you are Jewish, you were raised in a secular family, and you are an agnostic. You write that you got the idea to do this book from your uncle Gil, who was not secular. Tell us about him and how he inspired you.
Right. Well, as you say, I was not very religious. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian, so not very. But I had kids, and I wanted to know what to teach them about my heritage and about the Bible. So I thought one way to learn would be to really dive in and learn about the Bible from the inside out by actually living it. And I have an uncle who's an interesting character, and he is has been through every religion. He's been a Buddhist, a Hindu, evangelical Christian, an Orthodox Jew. And at one point during his journey, he decided to take the Bible completely literally. And there's a passage in the Bible that says, "You shall keep your money close at hand." And most people interpret this metaphorically, but he took it literally, and he took out all of his money from the bank and tied it around his hand with a string. And I thought that that was such an interesting, unusual approach, that maybe there's something to seeing what happens if you do take the Bible literally.
Mm-hmm. You focused on the Old Testament or the New Testament?
Mostly the Old, but I did explore the New as well.
So how did you set up your ground rules for living biblically?
Well, first I got a board of spiritual advisors, so I had rabbis and ministers and priests, and then I wrote down every rule that I could find in the Bible, and as you probably know, there are hundreds of them, and I wanted to follow them all without picking and choosing. So I wanted to follow the famous ones, like the Ten Commandments and love your neighbor, but I also wanted to follow the lesser-known ones. You know, the Bible says that you cannot shave the corners of your beard, and I didn't know where the corners were, so I just let the whole thing grow, and by the end I had this topiary hanging from my chin, and I looked, you know, to put it this way, I spent a lot of time at airport security. That's kind of how I looked. The Bible says you cannot wear clothes made of mixed fibers, and this seems so strange. You know, why would God care about it? But I figured there's no way for me to know if it has any meaning than if I try it. So I got rid of all of my polycotton clothes. So it was a fascinating journey from the most basic rules like, you know, don't lie, don't covet, don't gossip, which, by the way, I live in New York and I'm a journalist, so that was 80% of my day. That was no easy feat. But I also had to do some of the lesser known rules that were fascinating and obscure, but enlightening all the same.
Did you find that you could, in fact, follow all the rules that you listed from the Bible, or were some of them were just you had to adapt or just rule out because they weren't possible in the 21st century?
Right. Yeah, there are some that are pretty difficult. You know, the Hebrew scriptures talk a lot about that you have to stone adulterers, and I found that to be challenging. I did stone one adulterer.
Wait, challenging? You mean you did do it?
Well, what happened was I used very small stones, pebbles, but I was able to throw one pebble at an adulterer, and I felt that was my way of checking it off the list.
And the reaction of the adulterer?
He was not overjoyed. He was, even though it was small, it was actually a bit of a tense situation. So that is something after the year I shaved off my beard, I definitely put down the pebbles. But there's much that I continued doing.
Did you find any rules in the Bible that really made a lot of sense, that were not hard to follow at all?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there were many, many that changed my life for the better. The Bible says, for instance, the Bible says that you should give thanks. So I took this literally, and I was giving thanks for everything. So I would press the elevator button, and I would be thankful the elevator came. I'd get in the elevator, and I'd be thankful it didn't plummet to the basement and break my collarbone. And it was a weird way to live, but it was also wonderful because you realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we totally take for granted, mm-hmm. and that we focus on the three or four that go wrong. Also, learning to try not to gossip and covet and lie. You know, I still do it all the time, but I think I've been able to cut back about 40%, 50 maybe even on a good day. Mm-hmm. So that was a big improvement. And it was difficult. You know, how do you do a moral makeover? How do you become a better person? One of the secrets I learned from this experiment was that you pretend to be a better person, and eventually you become a little bit of a better person. So you ask yourself, what would a compassionate person do in this situation? And then you do that. So there was an idea of fake it till you make it on an ethical scale.
Mm. What were some of the most baffling rules that you found in the Bible that perhaps you hadn't known until reading it? Because that's the way you started out this project, wasn't it, reading the Bible cover to cover?
Right, and there are quite a few that are hard to figure out on first glance. You know, the Bible says, don't wear clothes made of mixed fibers. There's a rule in the Bible that says if two men are in a fight and the wife of one of those men grabs the private parts of the other man, then her hand shall be cut off. So that one I followed by default, by not getting in a fight with another man whose wife was standing nearby looking like she had a strong grip.
In this book, you visit various religious groups who, to some degree, I think, claim to live in literal accordance with the way the Bible commands people to live. Tell us about which groups you decided to visit.
Yeah, I embedded myself in different religious groups to see how they interpreted the Bible. So I spent a lot of time with the Amish, who take some parts very, very literally.
In Pennsylvania. We have Amish here in Iowa as well, but you were in Pennsylvania, right?
Right. I was in Lancaster County. Spent a lot of time with evangelical Christians, Orthodox Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses. And by the way, I think I don't want to boast because that's not biblical, but I do believe that I might be the first person in America to out-Bible talk a Jehovah's Witness. He came over to my house, and after 3.5 hours, he looked at his watch and he's like, I got to go. I can't take this anymore. So but I was just so fascinated in his point of view.
When you encountered these groups and embedded yourself, as you say, did it take something to convince them to host you? Did any turn you away?
A little bit, but much less than I expected. And I think that was because even though this book sort of has a light touch, I hope, I really was taking this project seriously in that I did want to find out what I was missing by having no religion. What mm-hmm. are the advantages of what are the pros and cons of a religious life? So I wasn't going in with an axe to grind. I was really going in openly and curiously. And so hopefully they sensed that and they were very open with their point of view. And I think it shows. I think, you know, even if I disagreed with a group, there was still some wisdom to be had from their point of view that I was able to take away.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is A.J. Jacobs. His latest book is Drop Dead Healthy, One Man's Humble Quest for Bodily Perfection from 2012. But we're talking this half hour about his 2007 book titled The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. So let's talk a little bit about how this experience, living biblically, changed you. You come from a secular Jewish background, as we talked about in the beginning. How did your views on biblical literalism change after these experiences and after writing this book?
Well, I did become I don't know if you would call it religious, but I joined a synagogue in our neighborhood. And it's a Reform synagogue, and we don't go all that often. But we try. That's a good first step. And the reason is I want to teach my kids some foundation of our heritage, you know, just give them a taste so they can later choose from a place of knowledge. So it definitely changed my view on that. And in terms of literalism, it confirmed my view that you can take the Bible seriously without taking it literally. And I met many people who did this. You know, there are some groups who say that we have to take everything in the Bible literally or else none of it has any meaning. And that informs their views on homosexuality and on creationism. But I found that if you do take everything literally, then you're going to be acting a bit like a crazy person, you know, throwing pebbles at adulterers. So we all do this picking and choosing of the Bible. And we do focus on parts and sort of gloss over other parts. And some people think this is bad. There's a term, cafeteria religion, and it's used in a denigrating manner. But I actually think my response is, what's wrong with cafeterias? I've had some delicious meals at cafeterias. So the key is to focus on the parts of the Bible about compassion and loving your neighbor. And there are so much wonderful, many wonderful passages in the Bible that you can focus on instead of the ones on intolerance.
Mm-hmm. So I think you just answered the question. My question was, so what does it mean to take the Bible seriously, if not literally?
Right. It just means that finding ways to wrestle with the Bible instead of saying, oh, the Bible says homosexuality is a sin, therefore I'm going to believe it's a sin. You know, I believe there's one rabbi who told me that the words of the Bible are eternal, but the meaning evolves. So I am in that camp. I do think that religion and meaning can evolve. I feel the same way about the Constitution. I'm not in the Antonin Scalia original intent group. I think that for something to have meaning in today's world, it has to change and adapt. And that's the way I feel about the Bible.
Did your year of living biblically challenge your agnosticism?
Absolutely. That was interesting. I mean, I started as an agnostic, and I was – one of the things I did was the Bible says to pray. So I was praying 5-6 times a day, and because of cognitive dissonance, because of this idea that when you act in a certain way, you start to believe in that, I started to believe in God, which was fascinating. But in the end, when I stopped praying quite as much, I sort of went back to an agnosticism, but it was a different agnosticism. One of my advisors, who was a Lutheran pastor, he calls it reverent agnosticism, because that's what I believe. I believe whether or not there's a God, there are things in life that can be sacred, like saying prayers of thanksgiving or rituals with your family. All these things can be sacred, and there's something very wonderful about that.
So there's, you have no problem being an agnostic and still engaging in prayer?
Well, I'd say prayer. I don't know if you want to call it prayer or just meditations on Thanksgiving. But yes, I do try to, you know, before a meal, I try to give thanks to the people who made it possible that we often take for granted, you know, the farmers or the truckers who drive it there, the people who, labeled the food. There's thousands of people involved in getting the food to your plate. And I think it's important to be aware of that.
I wonder if you gained through this project any idea of North America, the United States as a place of religion and faith that's different than a lot of places in the world. And we have a lot of different religious groups establishing themselves in the United States, and many of them very fringe groups, I guess you could say. Any thoughts on as to why the U.S. has become such a mecca for these types of communities?
Well, it is. Yeah, I think you're right. It is more religious than Europe in general. And one of the interesting things, I live in New York, and you can find almost every religious sect here. I did have to travel to – I visited the serpent handlers in Tennessee because I was so fascinated by their interpretation of the Bible. Those I could not find in New York, but almost everything else. I think it has a lot to do with our love of individuality and freedom, so everyone's free to pursue their own interpretation, which I think is great. And speaking of individuality, that was one of the lessons I learned from the Bible, was that in biblical times, there really was not this sense on the individual. There was not this focus on it. The smallest unit of society was considered the tribe or the family. And instead of seeing life as a series of rights, they saw life as a series of responsibilities to your elders, to your neighbors, to your friends. So I love that. I like the idea of balancing this view of life as rights and responsibilities, mm-hmm. and the individual and the community.
So tell us a little more about the serpent handlers you visited in Tennessee and how serpent handling can fit in with living biblically.
Well, serpent handling is based on the literal interpretation of a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says that you shall take up snakes in God's name. And so these people are just following that, and they take up poisonous snakes, and unfortunately sometimes the snakes bite them and they die. But it is it was fascinating to watch because they really did achieve some sort of religious ecstasy. I was in a very small church in Tennessee, just about 20 people, and the preacher took up this snake and he sort of went into this this state of joy, which I think is I love that aspect of religion of being a sort of a portal to joy. I would have preferred if he found another way to access this joy because I don't want him to be bitten by the snake. But he was a fascinating guy and very smart. He was not like, you know, a typical stereotype of a hick. He was and he was interestingly, he was very tolerant. He's like, this is the way I worship and I don't judge other people on how they worship, which I didn't see coming.
What has been some of the reaction of people to this book over the last few years? I imagine because you're in such a sensitive area, you expected some people to take this not in a light manner as you intended it.
That is so true. I was very nervous about the reaction, but I was also really pleasantly surprised because people were really overall very accepting, and I do a lot of speeches at churches and at synagogues, and I've gotten overall a wonderfully positive response from the religious community.
In fact, you've been invited around the country, like Iowa Wesleyan College, to speak about it.
There you go. I am coming this week. So yes, I'm very flattered, and I think it comes from that I really tried and hopefully achieved a bit doing this in a non-judgmental way and trying to find the good as well as the pros and the cons of religion. So I wasn't out to mock or to belittle. Mm-hmm. I really was trying to find out how it could make my life better.
Did you find out anything more about why we seem to gravitate towards having a faith, most of the American public, atheist aside, agnostic aside, I guess, why people yearn for that?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with actually being a part of community, which is one of my favorite parts of being part of the synagogue, is that and you don't actually need to be religious to be part of a community, but it is a very popular way to get in. And I think that's very healthy. There's studies that show that people who are religious tend to live a little bit longer. And that is mostly because they are in this tight-knit community that reinforces ethical behavior. And so that is, I think, a big attraction.
Well, you've been engaged in this, I guess you call it a self-improvement trinity the past few years. You've started off with your book, Know It All, Sharpening Your Mind. This book, The Year of Living Biblically, addressing faith and the spiritual side of a person. And your latest book, Drop Dead Healthy, to make over your body, become the healthiest person in the world. What next?
Well, I just finished an experiment for Esquire, which I thought was very—it was a fascinating experience. I had a tiny video camera that I put in my ear, and I videotaped every moment of my day from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to sleep. And the idea is that our memories are terrible, so here is—I can actually document it. So when I got in a fight with my wife, 70% of our arguments are— when she says, oh, that's not what you said, or I say, you didn't tell me that. Now we can go back. I say, well, let's go to the videotape and see what actually happened.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Oh No is right. It didn't always turn out that well.
Give us an idea of what it's been like for Julie, your wife, to be married to you. You're on this constantly seeking new experiments, throwing yourself into another realm and writing about it.
Yeah, my wife is a very patient woman, and I think it's a mixed experience for her. You know, for instance, the Bible book, sometimes she loved it. You know, I think I became a little bit of a better person, more thankful, I lied less. But at the same time, there were rules she hated. The Bible says you cannot touch women during their time of month. And she found – and actually, if you take Leviticus really literally, you cannot sit in a seat where a woman in her time of month has sat, because then the seat has become impure and then you become impure. So my wife found this offensive and sat in every seat in our apartment during her
stand.
What's that? Yeah, I had to stand, which turned out is quite healthy. So in that sense, she was helping me out.
H.A. Jacobs, it's been delightful to have you with us this hour.
Thank you, Ben. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for your visit to Iowa, and thank you for joining us this hour. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.